good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is May 15th, 2014. I'm Catherine Alston Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Well, lunch with Catherine in Marin County in California, Sunday, June 22nd. The information is up on the blog. We're going to be out in the field just like we were last June. Same place for those of you who attended. It was great. Wonderful big tents out in the fields of Marin County. Quite beautiful. So Sunday, June 22nd. It's a wonderful group of subscribers from that area, so you'll enjoy it if you come. June 28th to 29th, the Secret Space Program and Breakaway Civilization. That's going to be the following weekend. We looked into having a reception, and Convention Center was just not agreeable to doing what we needed to do. So we're going to go with a lunch in Marin County the Sunday before. But for those of you who are at the Secret Space Program, maybe let's try and get together and sort of organize a dinner during one of the dinners. I'm very happy to announce that one of my all-time favorite bloggers at the Nines.net, Nines has agreed to come and participate in the conference and will be blogging for us from the conference. And of course, you can also, you don't have to attend. If you're interested, you can also stream the event. Just get the stream tickets online. Our theme tonight is from our wonderful interviewer, Henrik Pohlgren, the founder and host of Red Ice Creations and Red Ice Radio. He says, if you don't inquire, you won't find out. And that's a philosophy I've tried to practice. I very much believe in. To me, reality is divided into two parts, the what I call the real deal and then the official reality. And to have a successful life, you have to navigate both of them. You need to not get squeezed or tricked by the differences. We live with enormous uncertainty. And I think one of the things that gets us the most in danger is self-censorship. It's a big problem right now in the financial community. Financial folks are trying to explain what's going on by staying within the official reality and the official statistics. And of course, they're getting crankier and going around in circles and getting more and more irrelevant. But they sound so confident. They sound like they know what they're doing. And of course, they don't. They're not willing to look at the weirder topics, which at this point, I think we have to. So it's very, very important to me. The reason I wanted to participate in the Secret Space Conference is it's an opportunity to get together with some pretty serious researchers who combine both having an open mind and being very creative with very, very serious scholarship and bringing a sort of an academic or serious investigative journal approach to the topics of what in the world is going on as it relates to what is the real governance system and what is the real financial system, which is the question I want to get to the bottom of. Money and markets, the slow burn is accelerating. The producer price index is just out for April. It jumped 0.6%. That's very significant for one month. It's three times what was expected. The core surging 0.5%, again, 0.2% expected. The big, and not surprising, if you've been to the grocery store lately, food surged 2.7%, unprocessed food 3.6%. That's extraordinary. You're talking about, Carl Denninger had a great piece called CPI Wow. It says citrus up 21% annualized, with most of it in oranges. Natural gas up 11.8%. And he says, of course, being a big, Carl's always beating the drum about Obamacare. And don't worry about hospital services. Obamacare fixed health care, remember? That's why hospital services are up more than three times the rate of general inflation over the last 12 months, running 6.8% annualized. Anyway, I know I keep saying this, but I'm just going to keep saying this. We need to get radical about how to make sure we get excellent food at affordable prices. Look into the terminal. If you're near a city, look into the terminal markets. You know, take turns every week getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning and running down and buying wholesale, you can save a lot of money and get very high quality. There are things like food clubs. I keep banging the drums for edible landscapes. I'll probably try and get Eric Tonsmeyer back this year because he's got a new book coming out on edible landscapes. Gardens, if you love to garden. And remember, within a neighborhood, we can organize and sort of slice things up in a variety of ways. But you need to take a look at your combined food and health budget and reinvent how you do it with a focus on making sure you get excellent fresh foods. Because, you know, if food prices are going up 3% in 1 month, you can imagine what that could translate into, not only on an annualized basis, but over a 3 to 5 year period. We're talking about extraordinary, or the potential for extraordinary increases in the price of fresh and healthy food. Jeffrey Smith's going to be back on the Solari Report to update us on what's going on in the squabble over GMOs. And so that's one of the reasons I wanted to get him back, because I think food and food prices are going to be incredibly important to each one of our budgets and our financial situation. The housing market just keeps getting stranger. Let me tell you a couple of strange things that happened this week, and they're up on the blog. An FHFA official was arrested for threatening the former head of the FHFA. So we're talking about physical violence between the chief operating office of the Federal Housing Finance Agency and the former executive director. So you know that things are tense in the mortgage markets when that happens. An even funnier one, somebody from George Mason University on their blog, Confounded Interest, put up a story about Paul Krugman being wrong about the housing bubble starting in 2002. In fact, it started in the Clinton administration, which it was. And the guy absolutely nailed the policies that really started it. And I posted a story from 1995 that proved his point on his blog. When the comment was moderated, when I went back to check, the whole blog had crashed. It was down. And when it finally came back up, his post about Krugman and that story were gone. I said, okay, things are tense in the housing market. Clearly they are. We have Chairwoman Yellen pointing to the softening in the housing market as a real concern for her. It's one of the reasons the feds have backed off on rising interest rates. We're seeing interest rates go down. And so when we turn and look at the markets have been trading sideways all since the beginning of the year, up, down, up, down. Equities are clearly under pressure, as we talked about last week, but bonds have performed reasonably well and treasuries are performing. And of course, bonds was the thing we were expecting to get out of this year with Yellen talking about interest rates rising. We've talked many times in the Solari Report about the long-term, you know, the turn in the long-term bond market, the bull market coming to an end and the turn that's coming. Nothing changes that long-term outlook, but there's no doubt that the short-term bonds are looking better. They had the best performance in the first quarter of any asset class, except selected areas and commodities. And then this morning, the Wall Street Journal, big headline, nervous investors pile into bonds. Of course, part of that is the seasonality issue. There's the old adage, sell in May and go away. And as I've talked about on the Solari Report, we talked to Chuck and I talked about it on the equity overview. We posted last week, more than 90% of gains in the U.S. markets historically have come between November and the end of May, not between May and the end of October. So for now, bonds are looking good, particularly, you know, so long treasuries are doing much better than anybody expected. Looking around the world, and you can see this on the blog, it's so clear, there is, you know, the competition over natural resources continues and is getting ugly. Ukraine, a constant reminder of that, but also the pain that everyone's feeling over constant currency debasement and what that means. A great note in Richard Mayberry's latest newsletter. He says the only long-term primary trends at this point are war and currency debasement. I don't disagree, but the point's well taken. If you look across all the stories in the blog, unbelievable number of stories about weapons and arms sales, as though our whole economy depends on it. We have NATO telling Eastern European members They need to spend more on arms. France refuses to block its warship deal with Russia because of the sanctions. Japan is allowing U.S. drones to be based in Japan to spy on China. China and Vietnam squabbling over a drilling rig in the South China Sea. South China Sea is going to be just an area of more and more tension. We post a lot on that in the blog if you're interested. The Iran talks, they're still trying to work out the language on that. And of course, we continue to see all of the squabbles that we've got in the Ukraine. I had posted several months ago a short story from The Economist on the defense contractors. They were saying that foreign sales would offset their profit losses as a result of U.S. budget cuts. How did they know? And as you look around all the weapon sales and arms sales around the world, you wonder, okay, is this tensions being instigated by weapons manufacturers who need sales, or they're just responding to greater competition over natural resources? Now, part of what is really increasing the pain overall is that we're all spending time doing things that make the contraction worse. As we compete in negative ways, we make the contraction worse. And so, you know, you get into these downward spiral problems. Part of the problem here in this country, and as I've talked about many times, but more on the blog this week, we've shut off bank credit and equity to Main Street. So you're not seeing liquid credit flow, not through the banks, not through equity on Main Street. And then, of course, we've shut off the mortgage financing to the little guy, which is if you're a small business person and you can't get bank credit, you go to your mortgages. Well, we see Yellen now backpedaling. Big headline this week, again, Wall Street Journal, U.S. backs off on tightening in the mortgage market. So clearly the mortgage market's going to loosen up. It's not enough. We need to get bank credit and equity to at least be market-based, performance-based on Main Street. I put up a commentary this week. There was a very interesting crowdfunding proposal that I posted on the blog about taking solar technology and making roads with solar panels. It seems to me like a very productive multitasking for highways, and then doing lots of things with the highways to build a new infrastructure. It's the way we need to be thinking. And so I donated $50 and put it up and said, you know, we need to be doing millions of this because we need entrepreneurs going at these questions. Somebody sent me a tweet and said, is this really going to work? And I said, I have no idea. I think we need to try millions of these things. The important thing is when you go at the real solutions, what you need to do is you need to fail and you need to keep failing, because it's by failing that ultimately you find out what works. And it's a lot easier to try stuff and fail than it is to sit around and plan forever. So I think the idea of financing lots of entrepreneurs trying stuff is a great way to go. And to me, it's a lot better. If you look at how much money we spent on arms and missiles and all this other stuff, I assure you there's plenty of money around. To show you somebody who's thinking along the right lines, article up on the blog, China wants to build high-speed railway to U.S. through Siberia and Bering Strait. Okay, now there's somebody who's thinking about doing more with less, and again, application of technology to get our natural resources to go further. Part of the problem is privilege. I had a commentary up about that last week on the blog. I talked about it in last week's Solari report, but again, we're aggregating market share for geopolitical competition. So if we take the U.S. market and we aggregate it into few corporations, they're bigger for purposes of competing geopolitically. It lowers their cost of capital. The problem is you're shutting off capital to someone who's arguably much more productive. And a lot of that privilege has been arranged through Washington and sort of lawlessness and a double standard on about legal enforcement. So this is going to be a privilege issue, and you're starting to see more and more debate about privilege, including in the discussion of taxing the wealthy or grabbing portion from bank accounts. That's all a discussion of and sort of The Economist whining about crony capitalism. Now that the financial coup d'etat is over, there's a lot of bad behavior that's no longer productive. It was productive as long as you were trying to suck money out of things. But now that you've got it, you need a lot of that to go away. So we're going to see. We're watching a, a turn on the privileged. One way to look at all of this is, as I talked about in the wrap-up, but you know, the concept of global 2.0, which is the industrial model, global 3.0, which is the networked model. A lot of organizations can either, if they stay in 2.0, they've got to go to war, whether it's economic warfare or physical warfare. You know, the alternative is to turn and change to 3.0, because a lot of the 3.0 organizations and economy is doing much, much better. There are a couple of rules or guidelines that I like to talk about in this context. One is there is no way. I'm always having people say, well, where can I go to be safe? The dynamic that we're dealing with is global, and I'm not saying that there aren't places which are better for you than others. Everybody is different, and so certainly, you know, I think life in Switzerland is much more pleasant than it necessarily is in many parts of the United States. However, you know, these challenges are everywhere. You're going to face them everywhere, and so you might as well go to work on solutions where you are. I was looking at something on the internet today, and it said, blossom where you are. And that's exactly what we have to do. The second thing is, I continue to be very concerned watching people waste an enormous amount of time and money preparing for a collapse, which is very unlikely to come. The squeeze and destruction of the middle class in the developed world, yes, that's happening. But the kind of collapse that's being prepared for is, I think, is very, very unlikely. Please get off Facebook and different social media that uses entrainment. I'm appalled at the extent I've been preparing to use Twitter. I finally said, okay, you know, everybody wants us to use social media. Okay, we'll do Twitter. So I've been playing around with Twitter, getting ready to start tweeting out, which we should do starting in by June or July. And I've been appalled at how the whole system just keeps trying to send me into big corporate this, big corporate that. If, you know, if Twitter tries one more time to get me to sign up for Hillary Clinton's tweets, I'll just, you know, it's like, please, where is the button that says I have absolutely no interest in this? To give you a sense of the impact of social media, there's an excellent video from a professor at NYU up on the blog this week, Winners and Losers in the Digital Age. He echoes a lot of what I said in the annual wrap-up about the switch from 2.0 to 3.0, but I really encourage you to take a look at it. And another story on the internet that underscores the power of the switch, internet well on way to 3 billion users. Now, this is unprecedented, because we're talking about 3 billion people who can now shop globally and communicate globally. And this is, you know, this is an historical phenomena that we don't even begin to understand it. And it's happening at lightning speed. A couple of things I wanted to point out on the blog this week. I posted a commentary called For the Love of Learning, Beyond Main Core, Common Core, and the Data Beast. It's really about two things, more sort of yah-yah about how the educational system is being destroyed for the purpose of sort of centrally controlling and channeling human resource. But the sort of exciting thing is, once we get clear that we can't look to formal institutions to really organize our investment into building knowledge and learning and skills, we can't look to them for the curriculum we're going to need for the life we're going to live, you know, not just next month, but next year, over the 20, 30 years. We have to accept responsibility for our own learning journey, our own education, and we have to sort of avail ourselves of exploding number of resources throughout the world and the internet. So as one system is being destroyed by Common Core and things like it, a whole nother system is flourishing where information and skills and knowledge want to be free. And the minute we step back and say, look, I'm responsible to be a discerning consumer who uses my money and time to get the best skills, the best toolkit, you know, a lot opens up. So check that out. One of the things, if you haven't seen, you have to watch the documentary called The School. It's linked to from that commentary. One of the most exciting, hopeful documentaries I've ever seen in my life. That I continue to pound the drums over in Wild Cards last week and this week. Every time there is now another climate change pronouncement from the military, and you just, every time I want to take them all and make them watch all the videos on chemtrails. And so I've got a couple of chemtrails videos. I didn't post, but of course I'm a great admirer of Michael Murphy, who's made What Are They Spraying and Why Are They Spraying and Who's Spraying. His series is also good. I also posted links to waves of assassinations of scientists. So until somebody can explain to me what's going on with chemtrails and disappearing scientists, I really don't want to know what you've got to say on climate change, because I think it's all, you know, I think it's all not credible. Our hero this week is Jeroen van Straten, who is the organizer of Global BEM, who organized the Breakthrough Energy Conferences in Holland 2 years ago and then in Boulder last year, and then organized in 2011 in Holland and now this year in San Mateo, the Secret Space Program and Breakaway Civilization Conference. Jeroen and his colleagues are marvelous people. They're very hardworking. And they're absolutely committed to achieving transparency about our world. And they're fearless, not only in their ability to look at what's going on, but to try and find positive solutions. They really do believe that we're responsible. So wonderful people. And if you have a chance to attend the conference, you want to make sure you take some time and meet them. I also wanted to acknowledge Malik Bendelu, who was the director, the Swedish director of Searching for Sugarman. Fantastic documentary, if you haven't seen it. It is a must-watch. He died in Sweden at the age of 36. He won the Oscar for Searching for Sugarman. Extraordinarily talented and gifted young man, and it's too bad that he will not be with us. Ask Catherine got some great questions this week. Dear Catherine, it seems a lot of people bought gold because of predictions involving the collapse of the U.S. dollar, dire economic consequences coming our way, and eventual people needing to use this gold to buy goods and service in this futuristic Mad Max type of world that had been predicted. With so many people now recognizing that these dire predictions aren't coming true, could you potentially see a floodgate of people soon beginning to sell a lot of their own precious metals? Precious metals, if you look at the most recent Gallup poll, real estate is the preferred investment at 30%. Precious metals has dropped from above that down to 24%. Stocks now up to 24%, so it's tied. I see very strong long-term commitment to precious metals. So I think a lot of people are deeply distrustful of the system and they want that core position, particularly in coins that they control. There was a great article from Rambus that I republished on the blog several months ago. It's called Annihilation in the Precious Metals Markets. Are You Serious? And one of the people who posted Rambus Chartology talked about the likelihood of precious metals not having found a bottom and finding a bottom this summer. I think he talked about it going down to 1,100, that area, and the extent to which people, you know, another round of people would get flushed out. I think that is a possible scenario, although gold and silver have kind of held the line better than I expected over the last month. So they seem to be sort of stronger in terms of support, but the, you know, the summer hasn't really begun. So take a look at that. I think that scenario is a reasonable possibility. But I don't think it's going to shake out a lot of people who understand they want to have those coins for the worst case. And it's certainly, you know, if it breaks the 1,100 line this summer, I'll reconsider whether or not I think the precious metals primary trend up is going to reassert or not. But it's going to be hard to shake me out of my coins. I have read, next question, I've read that there are approximately 16 levels of security clearance above which we normally call top secret here in the U.S., and that the president isn't given the highest level of security clearance. From what you know about how the system operates, could this be true? The president absolutely does not have access to the greatest secrets in my experience. Usually it takes them quite a while to kind of figure out what's going on. I posted about 2 months ago, a wonderful story from Michael Sala's new book on the blog. Check it out, about Eisenhower having authorized the building of Area 51 and then creating the executive authorities for the CIA to run the security for Area 51, and then the CIA declining to keep him briefed and up to date about what was really going on. And he finally throws a complete hissy fit and calls him up and says if they don't get in his office right away and report to him about what's going on, he is going to fly out to Colorado, take the First Army, and invade Area 51. And knowing Eisenhower, he would do it. And one of the things that Sala sort of describes is the briefing by Eisenhower of Kennedy, and then Kennedy's efforts to rope in what we call the black, the black budget boys not working. And so there is a long history of the presidents being and the political appointees, the political lair being kept out of the deep lair that operates at a more of a civil servant military level. So I think that's very true. But the other thing, to be perfectly blunt, if you look at the federal government, it doesn't have information sovereignty. It doesn't have financial sovereignty. So if you're completely dependent on your creditors for money and, you know, the corporations are running your information systems and know everything that's going on, the reality is, in my experience, the White House is not in control. If you haven't heard my Red Button story, take a look at the video or any of the things we've done on the Red Button story. But the president is very much a prisoner of everybody wanting their check and depending on the bond market and the creditors and the and a sort of a huge infrastructure of defense contractors and private banks to run and control those operations. So I don't think the president is driving the bus, and I certainly don't think the president has a picture of what's going on. It never ceases to amaze me that when I get into a room at a board of directors level or a very high level, and I start to educate people, it's really amazing to me how little they know and how quickly I can educate them, which is why there's often a real effort to get me out of that boardroom as soon as possible. Oh no, they're going to listen to her. So it's always interesting me to see the faces of really smart corporate guys as you educate them about what's really going on. And it would be marvelous for the world if there was a way to do all of them at once. Next question. I just finished listening to your podcast with Richard Dolan on his new book and learned a lot, but there is a curious void in terms of what I knew before the podcast. In 2008, Paul A. LaViolette, I think is the way it's pronounced, wrote a book, Secret of Anti-Gravity Propulsion. In his book, he devotes a lot of space to presenting the life and career of a first magnitude American genius, Thomas Townsend Brown, who invented de novo the entire science and technology for providing anti-gravity propulsion with full gun control. I don't know about it, although I've read about Brown in some of Farrell's books, but I have ordered this book, and so I will try and learn some more, and the next time Farrell's on, I'll ask him about it as well. So I've not read that. The person asking the question says, I'm a retired professor of genetics and plant breeding. Fantastic. I keep posting stories on the blog about what's going on in the area in genetics. It's quite amazing and terrifying. Latest article just from CBS News is synthetic DNA replicated by living, I'm sorry, CBC News, synthetic DNA replicated by living organism for first time in U.S. study. Very scary stuff. Anyway, feel free to comment on what you think is important in the genetics area. We could absolutely use some big brain expertise here. It's a very dynamic area. Let's go to the movies. I wanted, because we were talking with Enrique about Secret Space Program, I wanted to bring up Stanley Kubrick's classic masterpiece, 2001, A Space Odyssey. The first thing I need to tell you is I think Stanley Kubrick was absolutely hands down one of the greatest directors who ever lived. His work is like an onion. You can peel it. There's another layer and you keep peeling it. His films told us more about both the real deal and sort of the relationship between the real deal and the official reality of any filmmaker. If you go back, there's so many. Lolita, Dr. Strangelove, Barry Lyndon, Eyes Wide Shut. These are classics. I was going through the list today again as I was preparing my thoughts, and I thought, you know, we should have a Kubrick festival and the Solari Report and just walk through all the different things his films has taught us. A Space Odyssey, 2001, A Space Odyssey. Somebody said to me today, you know, when it first came out, we had no idea what to do about it. It's presented in four acts, and it starts from the very beginning of man until way into the future of man. And it brings up a lot of the issues we need to think about as we move into space as a people. And so it's absolutely worth watching. It's a fascinating movie. A lot about our relationship with tools and technology, including artificial intelligence, which is something that Kubrick grappled with more than once. And also relationship with extraterrestrial life, and questions that we have to ask as we voyage into space. So it's one that sort of brings up the really deep questions. There's an interesting documentary that I watched about 6 months ago by a guy, a fellow named Jay Widener, who writes a lot about the symbols and symbology and things that Kubrick was telling us. So he tries to get into the deeper Kubrick. One of the things he says is that he talks about the controversy related to the Apollo moon landing. There have often been many people who said that the landing was never happened, that it was in fact shot in a sort of a movie context in the United States, and that a lot of the footage we're watching is really a movie. It's not a real moon landing. What Widener says is, in fact, which makes a whole lot of sense, there absolutely was a moon landing, but the Department of Defense didn't want to show the actual footage for national security reasons, and so they also needed as a sort of a cover story, one that had been done, and Space Odyssey was the cover that gave them the ability. For Kubrick, you know, using Space Odyssey and using those sets and using that research and that team to basically make one for the moon landing. Could that be true? You know, who knows? There are some remarkable indications that from the time of Space Odyssey on, Kubrick could pretty much do whatever he wanted. He had remarkable latitude to do what he wanted and to say what he wanted and to still get it published and distributed. But it's a very interesting take because there is a lot of deep stuff going on in Kubrick. So if you're interested in space and what's happening in space, definitely check out 2001, A Space Odyssey. Our interview, as we've discussed, is with Henrik Pohlgren, who's going to be the moderator of the Secret Space Conference. I was very excited because Henri is from Sweden and runs Red Ice Creation. He goes back and forth between Sweden and America. His wife's American. And he does a remarkable job of managing lots of speakers and people that he interviews on a very wide array of topics, including the most sort of uncertain and out of the box stuff. And he does a very good job, very grounded guy. And so he knows the speakers, he knows the topics. And so I wanted to get him to talk about what we're up to, why we're doing this, and what some of the really interesting and juicy stuff is going to be. So it's a very, very good interview about what we're all up to. And again, if you're in the San Mateo area, Northern California, I hope you come. If you're not, I hope you stream it. I think there's a lot that will go with these questions of how does the governance system and the financial system on planet Earth really work, and how does it relate to what in the world is going on in space, whether it's stuff coming from elsewhere in here or us going out there. Okay, that's it for this week. In closing, we have a great conversation with Lawrence Gonzalez on deep survival. Next week, he's This is his second time on the Saleri Report. We had him early on when in 2009 we talked about his book Deep Survival, one of the best books on how to deal with trouble and stress I have ever read. It's a remarkable book, and he has a follow up, and so I wanted to get him back to talk about it. Then May 29th, I'm very excited, we'll be talking with Peter Gerlinek, Music, Writing, and the Creative Process. Peter is the author of my favorite biography in the world, Last Train to Memphis, about Elvis Presley. If you love biographies, it's absolutely the best. And I wanted to talk with Peter because we have been talking in the Saleri Report about music and the arts as it relates to reviving economies and economic development. I think it's absolutely critical. And Peter is someone who has, talk about the real deal, has written many different books on the history, particularly of music coming from the African-American community, and has tracked everyone from Robert Johnson to Sam Cooke to Otis Redding to Aretha Franklin, and a remarkable job of providing biography and chronology of some of the most remarkable American music that has had a very profound impact on our culture, and I think very important to what could happen in America if we're going to revive and be healthy as a people. Anyway, very talented guy, and I'm excited about that. And then a Jeffrey Smith back to talk about GMOs, and then Franklin will be back to talk about hard money the week after. So until next week with Lawrence Gonzalez, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.